Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, the lights of the night, the stars who are your company dance with you. Teach us the mystery of your dance, we may be in harmony with you. Learn to give away and renew. Oh, Moon Mother, your loving gaze falls softly on the sacred mountains. Oh, Moon Mother, your shining gaze falls softly on the sacred ocean.
Good evening and welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine fans out there. This is Karen Tate, your hostess, and may I say how much I appreciate you spending your valuable time with me tonight, and hopefully most Wednesday nights, whether it's live or later from the archives, if that's more convenient for you. And I have a wonderful accomplishment to share with you right at the top of the show. Turns out Blog Talk has been keeping their eye on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, and last week they actually featured our show. You might recall, if you tuned in, we had Esther Luttrell, author of Dear Dean, Love Mom, on the show, and she was talking about her paranormal connections and communications with her son Dean over the past years from the other side. Wow, the show getting featured was quite a coup, and it's brought more attention to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. So I invite you to join our ever-growing family if you're new to us. We talk about the Sacred Feminine as a deity, archetype, and ideal. We'll cover politics, women's issues, metaphysics, history and spirituality, archaeology. Our topics span global issues as well. And also what's happening right here in Southern California where I am. So I hope you stick around and become a friend and family of the show. And I want to be sure to thank Esther. Besides being an insightful guest, she actually took the time to write me the next day and say not only did she enjoy the interview, but she wanted me to know she's been interviewed a lot of times by a lot of hosts over the years, and she really enjoyed my style, as she called it. She said, I do better than some folks out there getting paid to do radio. So that was a feather in my cap. Thanks, Esther. And, you know, I do really love doing the show. It's my passion, and I can only dream that maybe one day I might actually do this for a living. But I've been told to set my intention, so are you listening, Goddess? I'm sending my heartfelt wish, if it's in your cards for me, that a professional and paid radio gig is my destiny. Bring it on. Your daughter's ready. And speaking of mothers and daughters, Sunday was Mother's Day. And I hope all you creatrixes out there had a wonderful day, however you chose to spend it. If you'd like to call in later and share some thoughts on Mother's Day or what you did to celebrate yourself or our great mother, please do. Roy, my husband, and I, we've been married almost a quarter century, and we're childless by choice. We just parent two darling feline daughters named Isis and Xena. So we have actually renamed Mother's Day. We call it Lover's Day. We do the same thing again on Father's Day. Well, we decided to spend Lover's Day up at our house in the mountains, feeding the birds, quietly watching the new baby rabbits and quail who were using our place as a crossroads as they went hither and yon. The blue jays were squawking and fighting over peanuts out on the deck, and I managed to tune out the fact the deck needs a paint job again already. Saturday, I taught Cakes for the Queen of Heaven at the Goddess Temple in Orange County. Got lots of great feedback from the students. So thank you, ladies. And so it felt like a really satisfying Lover's Day weekend for me. And hey, here's a little carrot. If you're the first one of my Cakes students to email me with comments about the show and our What's the Buzz segments tonight, you'll win a free book. So it pays to listen, students. But let's begin to shift our focus to tonight's show. Tonight, our guest is an American writer who's been living in Lancashire, England since 2002, and she's calling us tonight from Britain at the wee hours of the morning to discuss her new fiction book, Daughters of the Witching Hill, which is the true story of the Pendle witches from Pendle Forest who were hanged as witches around 1612. We'll get right into our topic, which is Women of Power, Exploring the Sacred Feminine via the Ancestral Lore of the Pendle Witches, in a few brief moments. But first, let me give you a glimpse into what's the buzz that's going to be happening later on tonight after we say goodbye to our guest. Yep, what's the buzz? It's the segment of the show when I tell you about those pesky bees that have been buzzing around in my bonnet all week, both good and bad. Tonight we're going to give you some good news, though, because it is out there. You just have to look. And the first item that we'll talk about is, while victory isn't complete yet, the Federal Communications Commission took a step in the right direction by announcing the FCC's intention to regulate broadband in order to ensure net neutrality on the Internet. And I'll tell you why that's important later. We're going to highlight some young feminists out there making a difference in the world at different universities around the country. There was an archaeological site discovered in Syria where goddess artifacts were found, so you'll hear about that. And we'll be sure to mention the tireless efforts for equality and justice by Dorothy Height, who passed away just a short time ago. And thanks, too, to Lisa Thiel, the wonderful singer-songwriter whose music you heard a brief snippet of at the top of the show. I've been highlighting Lisa's music for the last several weeks because there's not a piece of hers I don't like. Tonight you were listening to Moon Mother. Appropriate, I think, with tonight's interview being a witchy theme. And if you want more information about Lisa and how to obtain her music, please go to sacreddream.com. But now it's time to talk to our guest, Mary Sherratt. Let me tell you a bit about Mary. Well, Mary is, as I said already, she's an American writer who's been living in England. She's the author of the critically acclaimed novels Summit Avenue, The Real Minerva, and The Vanishing Point. She is also the co-editor of the subversive fiction anthology Bitch Lit, a celebration of female anti-heroes, strong women who break all the rules. Sounds like my kind of zine. So, Mary, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Karen. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Well, I appreciate you staying up so late tonight, and I promise I'll keep you awake. So, Mary, let's start at the very beginning. How is it you're an American writer in England? Why are you living over there?
Well, it's a very long story. I studied German at university, and so my first job was teaching English in Innsbruck, Austria, as part of a Fulbright program. So I was in a girls' school run by nuns in the Alps. It was very Sound of Music. And then at the end of the year, I got married. My husband's from Belgium, and he found a job in Munich. So we lived in Munich for many years. And then eventually, in the year 2000, we tried to settle in California because his company transferred in there. And we thought, oh, I'll be American now. And then that job kind of disappeared. And my husband accepted a job in the north of England. And that's how we ended up there then in 2002. And so we ended up living out in the countryside. And so it was an interesting place to sort of suddenly find myself. It's kind of off the beaten track. There aren't a whole lot of Americans up here where I live. And then the countryside and the culture and all the folklore associated with the countryside was so powerful. And then I learned the history behind the folklore, which was even more powerful.
Well, that's what we'll get to next. So the Pendle Witches, actually their name isn't Pendle, right? Pendle is the area.
The region.
Background.
Yeah, the region is Pendle. Pendle Hill and Pendle Forest is where they lived. And forest isn't actually a woodland. It was an old baronial hunting ground. So when you see forest in old manuscripts, they're talking about a hunting ground, not necessarily a woodland. So that's the background to Pendle Forest.
I see. And so these were real historical characters that comprise the characters of your book?
Yes, exactly. In 1612, there was a witch trial in Lancaster, and nine people from Pendle Forest, seven women and two men, were hanged on witchcraft charges. The person who's at the center of my book, though, she died in prison before she could come to trial, and she was the most notorious of the accused, Elizabeth Southern's alias Mother Demdike. And she was so notorious and had such a huge reputation that although she was dead at the time of the trial, they spent a lot of time talking about her and how notorious and dangerous she was and how it wasn't safe for anybody to live close to this really scary woman.
So in your research, though, has she sort of been, painted with the evil stick, or is it just that she was maybe an uppity woman who, wouldn't conform to society's mores? Was she an evil person or no?
I certainly don't think she was evil. She was a very strong woman and knew what she wanted, and I think powerful women are scary. And, one of the things that they wrote about her is no man escaped her and her furies. She was a cunning woman of a very long reputation. She was a healer. When interrogated by her magistrate, she made no attempt to hide what she was. She was proud of her powers. She was a cunning woman and a healer and had worked at her craft for decades. So nobody stopped her until she was 80 years old when she was finally arrested. But for most of her life, she went on with her craft and her career, and she was very proud of what she was and made no attempt to hide it.
I bet she birthed many a baby in that Pendle area.
I'm sure.
Well, now, No, go ahead.
It's in the documented evidence that the neighbors called on her to heal both their children and their cattle. So I thought that was very interesting in the trial documentation.
Okay. Well, at any point, if I ask you too many questions that give too much away, just say, got to read the book for that one.
Okay.
But now, I, in reading the description of the book, it's said that the history of the witches is lurid. And whenever I see that word, I'm suspicious, Is it lurid because of the bias of the Christian lens at work?
Well, the history isn't lurid, but some of the books that have been written about them are lurid. They take the most ghoulish aspects of the witch trial and kind of blow these historical people, these real people, up into these cartoon witches and figures of evil. And I find that so disrespectful because they were real people that died on account of other people's ignorance.
Right.
So
right.
That's what I mean by lurid.
Well, and it's a shame to say, but it's still happening today. It would be nice if we could say, well, it ended 400 years ago or however many years ago, but it's still unfortunately happening today, and too often in the name of religion too.
Right.
But now you say Beth Southern calls upon. Now I found this really interesting. It seems like a dichotomy. Her Catholic folk magic. It sounds like we're talking about opposites there. Why? How is it Catholic folk magic?
Well, her charms and spells are recorded in the trial documents as evidence of satanic witchcraft. Obviously, that's what they wanted to convict her of. But her charms that are quoted by the prosecution as evidence of this diabolical witchcraft are Catholic prayer charms. And that's in the primary source. Anyone can access this document online, Thomas Potts's wonderful discovery of witches in the county of Lancaster, and read the actual text of her spells. It's on my website also. So she was 80 years old in 1612, so she would have remembered the old church before the Reformation. In earliest childhood, she would have had an inkling of it. And so forth, because the English Reformation really didn't become enforced until Edward, King Henry VIII's son, came into power and so forth. So anyway, these were the charms she used. They were Catholic prayer charms, and obviously she seemed to have a very sincere belief in these prayers. On the other hand, she worked with a familiar spirit named Tib, who seemed to be the source of all her magic, and they had this partnership that lasted for decades. So there seemed to be something syncretic going on, both this belief in this outlawed form of Christianity and also a belief in the spirit world. And the belief in familiar spirits seems to be connected also to the lingering belief in fairies and elves, the fairy faith. And so that seems to be a connection there. So what she practiced seemed to be some kind of syncretic folk magic that embraced elements of Christian and possibly non-Christian belief as well.
And obviously nature, nature yes, spirits yes. and elementals and things like that too.
Yes.
So I got it. Am I getting it right? She her charms were Catholic charms, but in the interest of convicting her, they called them satanic.
Yes. After the Reformation, Catholicism in England became literally demonized and conflated with witchcraft.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was the most surprising thing I discovered in my research, is that it really became conflated with witchcraft. So you see these 17th century engravings of a friar in a magic circle waving his rosary around to cast to conjure imps.
Oh.
Seriously.
Well, you know what? You have just blown me away. I had no idea about that. Well, you know, we hear now sometimes, it's really funny, you know, some of my friends are folklorists and anthropologists, and, you know, they just giggle sometimes. They'll call me or email me, and they'll say, Karen, I just got to tell you what the Christians are doing. They're doing stuff that witches do, and they don't even know they're doing it, you know. You know, one just short recollection was, there was this love affair gone bad, and the wife was doing a spell, you know, burning a poppet of her husband and the girlfriend in a bowl, and I'm thinking, and, you know, they have no idea, do they? it's so funny. Well, you know what, I do want to get to the, you know, more about the characters, you know, the fairy spirits, fairy faith and all of that. But first, you know, one of the, you know, things I wanted to get to was how fiction writers, how it's so important that they give themselves permission, and we give them permission to really become the living voice for an ancient tradition. You know, I think it helps us to revive maybe our ancestral memory or DNA or something. You know, I think about Marion Zimmer Bradley's Myths of Avalon.
Yeah.
You know, that book was pivotal for me personally, you know, influencing
yeah.
me about, you know, how I saw the lives, you know, power and importance of ancient priestesses. And, you know, that was one of the reasons I really wanted to have you on, because we don't have a lot of fiction writers that that come on the show. So if you want to speak to that a little bit, I'd like to, you know, hear if you concur or what you can add. Or.
Well, I write historical fiction. Everything, all the books I've ever written have been historical fiction. And I write about women in history, and I think historical fiction writers play a crucial role in reclaiming women's history, because women's history keeps getting lost and buried, but it's our job to dig it out again and rescue these people from obscurity. And I think that historical fiction also serves ancestral memory. When I was writing this book, my characters, Bess Southerns and her granddaughter, Allison, who narrates the second half of the book, they weren't just fictional characters, they were real people, and I had a real sense of them. While I was writing the book, I could, you know, it sounds corny, but I could hear their voices, and I wanted to let them speak through me. I wanted to give them what their world denied them, their own voice, so they could finally tell their side of the story, and that justice could finally be served as far as they were concerned, because they were treated so unjustly during their lifetime. So I felt very protective towards them. I felt like they're not blood ancestors, but they became ancestors of my heart. I felt this very strong emotional connection with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I did this storytelling workshop with the British storyteller Hugh Lupton a few years ago, and he said something that's always stayed in my mind. He said, if you go deep enough into the old stories and can present them in a meaningful way to a modern audience, you become the living voice in an ancient tradition. And I think that's the highest calling that any kind of storyteller can have, to serve this ancient tradition, to become a living voice. And so that was why I wrote this book. I wanted to serve their memory and bring them justice.
Now, was it very difficult to research and then put on paper what their everyday life was like, you know, how they practiced their craft? I mean, were you able to find that information easy enough, or did you have to sort of trust whatever you were channeling?
Well, I did as much research as I could, not just reading, also going to the physical locations, going to Lancaster Castle where they were held in prison and so forth. I did a university course at the University of Lancaster on the whole background of late medieval belief and superstition and the pre-Reformation church and so forth. I studied up as much as I could to try to bring their whole worldview alive. And also trying to recreate their magic from what was left, the spells that were listed in the trial documents, and also trying to find the best way to kind of present this kind of dual belief on the one hand and these prayer charms on the other hand and these spirits that they worked with, and trying to show this as a coherent whole. So I based it on research, but also I had to use my imagination too to fill in the gaps, you know, with fiction, which is what fiction writers can do that historians aren't allowed to do.
That's true. You have it's a little bit more liberating, and you have a little bit more creative license there. So now the main character is Bess Southerns, right? Mm-hmm. And then her granddaughter is Allison. So now is the first part of the book about up until Bess's death, and then Allison takes over?
No. The first part is when Bess, it begins when she's about 50 and she first comes into her powers. She's a woman, a widow of 50 years old. She's impoverished. She lives in a place called Malkin Tower with her daughter and so forth. And she's so poor, she's reduced to begging. And one day she's out, she's walking past a quarry about sunset, and this beautiful young man steps out of the quarry. He has golden hair. His coat is half black, half brown, and he greets her by her name and says if she trusts him, he'll teach her all she needs to know about magic. And she blocks this out. She just can't take this seriously, but he keeps appearing and reappearing and reappearing, and she realizes that he is a spirit. And then gradually she begins to trust him, and she comes into her powers as a cunning woman with the help of this spirit friend.
And so I assume through her powers she's able to support herself and help the people of the village, and probably becomes an integral part of their little village society there.
Yes, she finds her powers and serves her community. Allison's narrative starts when she is 15. By this time, her grandmother has lost most of her eyesight, and she's very old and needs her granddaughter's help to walk around on her errands and to do her healing. And so her grandmother knows that she doesn't have much time left, and she wants Allison to carry on the family trade. And she sees the powers in Allison that Allison herself refuses to recognize. And so these women are, and this is based also on the history and how they seem to deal with their powers in the trial. Bess is very, very proud of what she is. She embraces her powers wholeheartedly, while Allison seems to be afraid of her powers, very uncertain. She just seems to view it with trepidation, and she just wants to be a normal girl and live a normal life. And so her refusal of the call affects the entire fate of her extended family.
Oh, that's unfortunate. Well, now there's also something in the book about the magical worldview of Jacobean cunning folk. Tell us a little bit about that, and who are the cunning folk, and what should we know about that? Just tell us what you think we should know.
Well, first of all, I have to say that in this period, everyone believed in magic. So rich people believed in magic, poor people believed in magic, educated people, people that didn't have an education, everyone took magic for granted. Completely mainstream people believed in the reality of the spirit world. That's why there were witch trials, because people believed in these powers, right? And so cunning folk were the men and women who used charms and herbal cures to heal, foretell the future, and discover the location of stolen property. What they did was illegal, because cunning folk worked with spirits. Their familiar spirits were the basis of their magic. And working with spirits was regarded as sorcery, and according to the law books, sorcery was a hanging crime, even if you only worked for good. So even if all you did was healing charms, you were guilty of sorcery, therefore you could be arrested and be hanged. However, most cunning folk weren't arrested because people needed their services so much. Very few people could afford doctors. They were so expensive. So most people relied on these people for healing, not just themselves, but also their livestock, on whom their livelihood depended, and so forth. So if you were perceived as using your powers for good, you were a cunning man or a cunning woman. But if other people perceived you as using your powers for evil, you became a witch. And there's so many gray lines here, and it's all in the eye of the beholder. So if you use your magic to discover the location of stolen goods and say, okay, the blacksmith has your spinning wheel that went missing, the blacksmith could turn around and accuse you of slander and sorcery. And so then you would be, you know, persecuted as a witch. So it's very, very complicated.
Well, and I would imagine, too, I mean, we hear all the time that if you ran afoul of the wrong person, or maybe if they wanted your property or something like that, it was an easy accusation to probably make.
The English laws protected people more than on the continent. It wasn't so easy to get someone's property necessarily by accusing them of witchcraft. And most of the people accused of witchcraft didn't own any property anyway. I mean, most of them were these poor old women that were considered a social burden on the local parish, you know, kind of the undeserving poor. These, like, even today we have this dread of older people that no longer seem useful in our society. I mean, most people were poor and not people of property, although
right.
That functioned differently in continental Europe. But, yeah, I mean, a lot of it was this misogyny and the dread of old women.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, when you said the age of Bess, she came into her power when she was probably a crone.
Yeah, yeah, around the age of, they said she had been a witch for 50 years at the time of her trial, and she claimed that she'd been a witch for 30 years, so I did the math and decided that she came into her powers around the age of 50.
Okay. Well, now, there's also images of the sacred feminine in the novel. Why don't you tell us about that?
She seemed to practice a very syncretic faith, a very syncretic form of folk magic. On the one hand, her Catholic prayer charms invoke the Virgin Mary as this powerful force of inspiration and healing. Her charm to cure a person who is bewitched is this very beautiful, moving, poetic description of the Passion of Christ as witnessed by Mary. And Mary's powers are invoked. Let the little child go to its mother mild. So this whole power is invoked. And the dual belief in the fairy world and the spirit world, in my novel, I have her with a powerful vision of the Queen of Elfame, this woman, the Queen of the Fairies. And that is actually not based on anything in the primary sources that I was able to find written down, but extrapolated from the local folklore. There was a man in Clitheroe in Lancashire, very close to where they lived, and he wrote a book that was published in 1677 called The Displaying of Supposed Witchcraft. He was a skeptic. He thought that most people accused of satanic witchcraft were just innocent, and he didn't believe that they were evil. But he was talking about a cunning man that he knew who claimed that his familiar spirit was none other than the Queen of Elfame herself. And so I extrapolated that and gave this belief in the Queen of Elfame to Bess and her family.
I see. Well, and I couldn't help but think, as you were talking about the fairies, and I'm sort of connecting that with the elements of the land, or are you anywhere near Findhorn? Is that, I forget now if that's in England or Scotland.
Oh, that's in Scotland. Yeah, it's quite a ways away.
Okay, because I believe have this belief that they are actually working with the nature spirits, and they do wonderful things up there. And I don't know, my brain's connecting the dots here. So what more can you tell us about the fairy faith in English folk magic?
Well, it seemed to exist for centuries alongside mainstream Christianity, and people seem to have the syncretic belief in both, which is interesting. there's a lot of history made about the, you know, a lot of historic scholars have debated what historical witches and cunning folk actually believed in. And if you read, you know, Ronald Hutton and all these people, they say it's very hard to substantiate that people in this period still worship pagan gods and goddesses. It's very difficult to find evidence to substantiate this. But this fairy faith is well substantiated. Shakespeare alludes to it. People like John Webster and his displaying of supposed witchcraft. There, Robert Kirk in the 17th century, I think he wrote The Secret Commonwealth. And he was a minister, a Protestant minister, and he wrote a whole book about the fairy faith. So these beliefs were real, and people carried them with them. So that is substantiated, and that's well within the realm of possibility.
So in other words, when the belief in the pagan gods and goddesses sort of waned, their belief in the fairy faith remained or took its place.
We can't say for sure that this happened, but that's what I would, you know, that's something that I would extrapolate from it, because the gods of an old religion might become diminished into these fairy figures or these elf figures. Another possibility is another level of being, like in the Norse mythology, the light elves that weren't considered part of the gods, but another being altogether.
Interesting. Well, now you have another character in the book, Mother Demdike. How does she fit into all of this?
Oh, Mother Demdike is this. She's the protagonist. Do you mean Mother Chaddox?
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
Mother Chaddox was the same age. She was also 80 years old at the time of her arrest. And based on the trial documents, these two women had this very complicated relationship. They, on the surface, they were rivals and blood enemies, and when arrested, they did everything to incriminate the other, and their families were feuding, and they wanted to incriminate each other, especially Alison couldn't say enough negative things about Chaddox. But if you read between the lines, it seems that there was also this strong friendship that existed between these two women. And after Demdike died in prison, Chaddox is being interrogated by this horrible, sadistic jailer, Thomas Covell, who has a historical record of being terribly sadistic. They weren't allowed to torture people, but jailers could beat and starve their prisoners at will. And they were kept in this underground cell with no natural light. They were kept in the dark for 4 months while waiting for their trial, so that counts as torture to me. But anyway, he was trying to drag an even more damning confession out of Chaddox after holding her in this horrible prison. And what she says is she conjures up this beautiful relationship with her rival, Demdike, who is now dead. And she said she invited her to a feast in her home at Malkin Tower. And they were two poor women, and all of a sudden, out of nothing, Demdike conjured this wonderful feast, and everything was so beautiful. And they didn't have any candles burning, but their spirits provided the light. And she had this absolutely paradisical, you know, description of these two really close friends enjoying this beautiful meal together in this completely magical atmosphere.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
I heard about you recently posted on a blog. You were addressing, shifting gears a little bit. You posed the question whether women's fiction was taken as seriously as men's. Where did you come out on that?
Well, I just can't help noticing that men's fiction does seem to be taken more seriously. Like, I think a few of the points that I made in the article, or that I've referenced from other people's opinion on it, was there's no male equivalent to chick lit. You know, like chick lit is such a derogatory term, or it's become derogatory, and there's no equivalent for men's writing that's kind of like a bit more lighthearted.
Mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
If you write about serious issues, then they say, oh, you're writing all this misery lit, and you know, it's you're taking yourself too seriously. It's if you look at the books that get the buzz, like in literary fiction, you know, generally they're written by men. I mean, there are exceptions and women that do very well, but it seems that more men get reviewed, more reviewers are men. I just can't help noticing it.
Feels like it's a boys' club.
Yeah, and also women will read books by men, but men are more hesitant to read books by women.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. I wonder what that's about psychologically. I'll have to ask one of my shrink friends.
Yeah.
Well, now tell us a little bit about the anthology Bitch Lit, the female anti-hero.
Oh, that came out in 2006, and that was really fun to do. We did that with Crocus Books in Manchester, and it was mostly writers from Northwest England. And we just wanted it was kind of an antidote to chick lit. So it was about female anti-heroes who really take their power and run with it. And so we had a lot of fun with that. And we took it on the road. We did a show where we turned our stories into monologues, kind of inspired by Eve Ensler's vagina monologues.
Yeah.
But we did our bitch monologues. And we got quite a bit of good feedback on that. It was a really fun thing to do. So.
Sounds like it was fun.
Yeah.
Well, Mary, let's give listeners your website. Would it be the MaryCharette.com?
Yeah, MaryCharette.com, yeah.
Charette, MaryCharrett. So listeners, that's two R's and two T's, MaryCharrett.com. Well, Mary, have we covered all the points, or was there anything else you wanted to make sure listeners knew about your process or the women or the book?
I think we've mostly covered everything, but I think the lasting message that Mother Demdike has for women today is that to seize your powers and to dance with it for all it's worth.
I like that. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, now, is the book available in all the normal places, bookstores, online, all of that?
Yeah, it should be in all major bookstores, independents, online, and so forth.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, Mary, I'm going to not keep you too much longer. I know your eyelids are probably pretty heavy, but thank you, so much for doing this. Because as we said, it is important for fiction writers to be a voice for these ancient traditions. No doubt, what you've written is certainly making the characters happy because they seem like they didn't get a very fair shake in their life, and I'm sure it will lend a lot of insight into more accurately describe what happened during these times, how these women's lives actually transpired over time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, I hope people find it good and inspiring. So.
Okay. All right. So that's MaryCharrette.com. So I would encourage listeners to go take a look. And you have a review in Sage Woman, you said, coming out soon?
I have a feature article on Mother Demdike and my research and my experience researching her that's going to be out in the next issue.
Okay. All right. Well, I will leave you to go to bed and to go to sleep, and I thank you so very much for staying up in the middle of the night to be with us and our listeners, Mary. Best of luck to you and your book.
Thank you, Karen. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Good night.
Okay. Good night.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, a hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking. We talk about the feminine consciousness and how ideals of the great she offer us keys to a sustainable future, whether the great mother be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just will save the world. And you've been listening to Mary Charrette, author of the book Daughters of Witching Hill, talking to us about the witch hunts in Britain, which inspired her book, and how fictional authors give us some very vivid insights about the importance of being a voice for ancient traditions that have value for us today. Well, listeners, I think you've probably come to recognize that sound. That means we're coming to the threshold, into the bottom of the show, and I'm going to take a very brief 1 minute music break so that I can shift gears here and get ready for our What's the Buzz segment. And in that minute, I'm going to let you listen to something upbeat. It's Choose Love by Laura Kane. So stay with me, and I'll be right back.
I say I will. I'll take the ride. 'Cause I'd rather have connections, pleasure and pain, than be alone here with my pride. Okay, I'll take my shot. This time I'll take my chance. 'Cause that's all I'll have left. If I don't, if I won't choose love, and pride's all I'll have left. If I don't choose love.
There's another cue. Oh, those oh-so-important bees. Bees that buzz around and pollinate the flowers of our minds so that our awareness blooms. Well, tonight in our What's the Buzz segment, our first topic is the fact that we have some good news. While victory isn't complete yet, the Federal Communications Commission took a step in the right direction by announcing the FCC's intention to regulate broadband in order to ensure net neutrality on the Internet. Media reform advocates are confident that this is good news for preserving the open Internet and promoting universal access. The victory isn't complete, however. While Jen Achowski, the chairman, proposed reclassifying broadband as a telecommunications service so that the FCC has clear authority to protect consumers and promote competition, the chairman intends to use a procedure called forbearance to broadly waive all of the competition provisions of the Telecommunications Act. Considering that the National Broadband Plan noted 96% of Americans have at most only two choices of Internet service providers, we have a real problem with monopolies and duopolies. We need the FCC to make use of its statutory powers to address this issue, because we really can't risk getting to a situation, with these monopolies or having it get worse. We know about the banks that are too big to fail. Well, we can't have that with our Internet providers, too. The Commissioner Copps recognized that the announcement was a mixed bag, and they say that we need to maintain the level of vigilance in the coming weeks to make sure this goes in the right direction. They say the path we start down today must do more than just put this agency's authority over broadband back on life support. It must ensure our going forth healthy ability to protect consumers. One near-death experience is enough. By empowering the FCC to take action over the long haul, we'll ensure a full range of views and voices in this country will be heard over the people's airwaves, and a free and open Internet is a tool which every citizen is able to access. Again, why this is so important? Well, imagine, we can't have the Internet become an instrument controlled by corporations or one political party, like, say, Fox News, or we lose all hope of getting any truth on issues out there in the public. You know, we'll only be able to hear what they want us to hear. So it can be very dangerous. Let's see. Secondly, we're going to highlight some feminists out there who are making the news, important ladies. First of all, Boston University, the Boston University Women's Resource Center, one of the only women's centers in the nation, run completely by student volunteers, has shown us the power of perseverance and just how much you can do with limited resources. for their awesome ambition and dedication to creating a safe space for women on campus. The Boston U Women's Resource Center wins a FEMI. That's an award from the feminist majority. The Women's Resource Center officially opened its doors in October of 2008, but it has a long and storied history. For more than 30 years, feminists on campus worked to establish a women's center at BU as a permanent home for their very active student groups. When the women's center was finally granted to them, students quickly put together a detailed organizational structure that guarantees the WRC can put on tons of events and be a comfortable space for conversation around gender and sexuality issues, despite the lack of a large budget or paid staff. A 13-person board runs the center with the help of 50 student volunteers. They're open every weekday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and it's a safe space where students can ask questions, get referrals from volunteers to different services on campus. So good news, ladies, at Boston U. Now, Cal Poly in California, they get the FEMI Award for Best Fight Against the CPC. CPC is Crisis Pregnancy Centers, which really give misleading information about women's reproductive health. They sound like it's something positive, but, you know, they're sort of a wolf in sheep's clothing. So anyway, after finding that Cal Poly Pomona was renting out space, office space to one of these crisis pregnancy centers located across the street from a student dorm, the Female Sexuality Society was determined to kick them off school property. After much hard work with tabling and informing students and getting coverage for their story in places like the Ms. Blog and Change.org, writing letters to the administration, all of that, you know, very unsexy hard work, they finally prevailed. The school listened. They said that they would not be renewing the crisis pregnancy center's lease next year, so that's a victory. So great work for Jackie Lara and Cal Poly's Pomona. You deserve your FEMI Award. You know, we see this over and over, how a cause will get support by misleading and manipulation. And, you know, that's what places like the Crisis Pregnancy Center do. It's also the MO of people like Fox News and the GOP. They create these organizations with a real friendly name, like they're in the interests of women or they're in the interests of Americans. And oftentimes it's really about restricting women's rights, you know, to get the information they need about their reproductive health, or it's something about, you know, protecting a corporation over the average American. We have to really be diligent. Let's see. Now, going up north to Kutztown, Pennsylvania, the Kutztown University Feminist Majority Leadership Alliance has consistently been committed to serving the Kutztown community and women across Pennsylvania. KU is a medium-sized public university about an hour from Philly and Harrisburg. Ellie, the president, likes to emphasize Kutztown's roots as a teacher's college, which is an empowering place for feminists to learn and change the world. The FMLA, led by junior Caitlin Smith, is unabashedly political and does great work advocating for women on campus and in the community year after year. Caitlin, Jesse, and all the other women there are the next generation of leaders for the feminist movement, and I know they'll be lifelong activists from whom we can expect big things. Just some of their list of accomplishments, because everything they do is too long to mention. They're bringing iconic feminist Gloria Steinem to campus. They've successfully petitioned the campus president to reinstate sexual orientation in the campus non-discrimination policy. They've contacted their senators to advocate for health care insurance reform. They sent a delegation of students to the Feminist Majority Foundation's National Young Feminist Leadership Conference. They have pay equity bake sales, Earth Day festivities, Take Back the Night, and the Clothesline Project. They sponsor vagina monologues and Love Your Body Day, Love Your Body Day, bra sizing T-shirts and posters. So lots to do, and you know, lots they're doing. So go, Kutztown Femmes. And let's see, one last group that I want to make sure we mention is in Alabama. Montevallo Feminist Majority at the University of Montevallo in Alabama shows just how in the depths of Southern conservative lies a mighty force of feminist power. And in the University of Montevallo's case, the student-led Montevallo's Feminist Majority is alive and well, ready to stomp out patriarchy in every corner of the campus community. The group began in 2005, and now under the leadership of Emily Salinas and Chris West, the organization has surged in membership and captured the attention of its campus media. Over the past year, they've consistently urged the administration to develop comprehensive sexual assault policies, and they're currently proposing a sexual assault victims advocate and peer education program. Additionally, members volunteer every Saturday out of the month escorting women entering the new Women All Women Clinic in downtown Birmingham. Last March, members drove 12 hours to Washington, D.C. to be part of the Southern Contingent for the Feminist Majority Foundation's annual National Young Feminist Leadership Conference. Not only did they learn a lot, but they took back with them some very valuable connections. So ladies, keep that feminist fire burning. Okay, we're going to switch gears here a little bit, and we're going to travel across the world to Syria. Because in the news this week, an archaeological site that dates to the 10th millennium BC the excavations had been going on, and they've actually found some goddess figurines made of flint. They say excavations began in the various archaeological sites that once housed farming communities, including Tel al-Abar, three sites on the left bank of the Euphrates River in northern Syria, which dates back to the 10th millennium BC. The structures contained various flint tools, such as blades, knives, sickles, arrow tips, hatchets, tools used for leatherwork and crafting straw mats, stone mills, pestles, pottery fragments, and animal bones and horns. Archaeologists on the site pointed out that the first communal buildings were decorated with engravings of animals, geometrical shapes in the sun. The floor is made of clay tiles painted with lime, while the ceiling is supported by wood pillars. The second communal building is circular with a diameter of 7 meters, consisting of five chambers with a square stone support pillar in the center. It also contained flint and stone tools, stone pottery. That's where they found the flint figurine representing a mother goddess, and also a clay figurine representing a half-human, half-animal creature, an ox horns. The findings indicate that the two communal buildings had a social and ritualistic role. The site plays an important role in answering questions regarding the emergence of farming in ancient times, as it clearly shows the characteristics of an organized village with a multitude of structures serving various purposes where people practice farming, hunting, and the manufacture of flint and stone tools. And they obviously venerated a mother goddess. Okay, we wanted to make sure before we close tonight's What's the Buzz that we mentioned about a week ago President Barack Obama eulogized fallen civil rights leader Dorothy Height, who was called a humble but tireless force for equality and justice. Speaking to hundreds of mourners gathered in the stately Washington National Cathedral, Obama recounted Height's quiet perseverance during decades of work, mostly behind the scenes, while the men of the movement got more attention and fame. Obama said she never cared about who got the credit. What she cared about was the cause of justice, the cause of equality, the cause of opportunity, and which is freedom's cause. Obama says he recounted that Height visited the White House 21 times. He noted she was determined to attend a meeting of African-American leaders on unemployment last winter despite an approaching blizzard and being confined in a wheelchair. In her words, she just couldn't allow just a bunch of men to control the meeting. Anyway, Dorothy Height, we honor you here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Thank you for your wisdom, courage, and tenacity. And from a Facebook follower, Jawanza Amenum, I hope I pronounced that right. These are his words. and it's peripherally associated with the International Summit on Indigenous Environmental Philosophy 2010, the Redstone Statement, and I think it's important and certainly worth repeating. Jawanza says, the ultimate aim of our humanity resides in our need to transcend it and essentially recognize that we are divine above all else. But the road to this noble end is preceded by our need to develop our humanity to its fullest potential first. Only when the kind of egoism that has steeped us in the separatist thinking and practices of xenophobia, racism, sexism, speciesism, and our unnatural interactions with the environment will this even be remotely possible. We must furthermore see ourselves, behave ourselves, and be ourselves as interconnected to all. And if indeed we are to transcend this humanness, the we must first be humane. We must respect all of those not so apparent integral parts of ourselves as the appendages of the sacred body of our divinity, and therefore make the body whole. Thank you very much, Jawanza and Yona, for sharing this with me so that I could share it with you. Well, that concludes our What's the Buzz segment for tonight. And remember, if you're a student in my Cakes for the Queen of Heaven class, and email me a synopsis of tonight's show or talk to me about the topics in the What's the Buzz segment, you will get a free book. And as long as everyone out there keeps telling me you think this What's the Buzz segment is important, I'll keep shedding light on the ideals of the sacred feminine, which are being honored out there in the world, or cover the ideas and ideals that are being oppressed. We have to be aware. We have to keep pushing back. Greed and the desire for power over others are way too pervasive. We cannot keep measuring our value by the size of our bank book or our list of assets. We have to counter toxic strategies and the imbalance and disharmony they create. We have to recognize how fear and greed is used to manipulate us. As one of my Facebook friends says, influential people out there have gift-wrapped greed and have convinced us it's a good thing, and we ignore the damage it does so many. Goddess is about the needs of the many, not the few at the top pulling the strings, destroying so many things in our country and our environment. Look at the recent mining disaster, the ongoing devastation in the Gulf, how Republicans don't even want reform on Wall Street so the rich can keep fleecing the weaker and the vulnerable. Capitalism has become predatory and out of control. You know, it used to be the ratio between what the owner of a company made and a worker was 50 to 1. Now it's 300 to 1. It used to be people automatically got health insurance with their job. Now corporations not only get tax breaks to outsource our jobs to other countries where they can really exploit labor and the environment, but right here at home they tried to get by with giving no benefits or working people a 38-hour week rather than a 40-hour week so that they're entitled to no benefits. It's not a fair system. It's getting close to servitude for way too many people. And this is not the norm. It didn't used to be this way. This does not have to be our future. But we have to wise up. We have to vote our economic interests and know who has our interest in their heart and know who's going to throw us under the bus. And I have to tell you, there's a lot of angry folks out there who are misinformed and angry at the wrong people. So, with that being said, the bees are released from my bonnet for yet another week. Well, this weekend I've been invited up to San Francisco to give a presentation at the Feminist Lutheran Church called Her Church. The talk is absolutely free, so if you're in the San Francisco area, I hope to see you there. And if you're the first person at the talk to mention you heard me say this on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, you'll receive something special, a special gift from me to you, so come say hello. The talk is going to be on goddess sites, the art of pilgrimage, and the esoterica and mystical phenomena of sacred sites around the world. So please come. And if you haven't already seen Her Church, I promise, if you're a goddess advocate, if you're interested in sacred feminine, if you're interested in you know, what progressives can do within the church, then I think you should meet Pastor Stacy Bourne and the wonderful work they're doing at her church. I'm also planning a sacred tour for women and men to Goddess Sites of Turkey for October 2011, so stay tuned and keep up with the developments on my website. This journey is going to be my third, and it will be a very experiential journey, as the rest have always been, complete with Turkish baths that will help us sort of, you know, get into our bodies and experience all the magic that Turkey has to offer. You know, Turkey is really a crossroads between so many different cultures. It's a treasure, and so many people haven't discovered it yet. And they're not on the euro yet, so, you know, our dollar will go much farther. We'll do dream journals and meditations and rituals at sacred sites. We'll visit archaeological museums and hopefully places like Chateau Hayuk, where we believe some of those early egalitarian societies and people who honored the goddess were living and worshiping side by side, men and women together. I know I'm only planning to take about 20 people, so if you think you want to be one of our group, please let me know. And speaking of Turkey, if you're in the LA area, don't miss the Anatolian Cultures and Food Festival in Orange County in Irvine. You can look that up. Let's see. Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, we have resumed our session 2, and you don't have to take the whole series. Classes are standalone, and we're getting into, in the second part, the imagery of the Judeo-Christian culture and how much of the female presence has been lost. We'll also get into witchcraft and Mary Magdalene and Mary the Mother of God and Sarah the priestess. And the final class will be about visioning a new world order, so to speak, with the sacred feminine restored and how that can change the world. And if you're interested in these classes, either online or you haven't been able to take them because Irvine in Southern California isn't convenient, but you could attend classes in Venice Beach on the west side of LA in the fall, please contact me, because these classes may happen if there's enough interest, and they will be open to men as well as women. And don't forget, the Getty Museum, until July 5th, has an exhibit called The Aztec Pantheon and the Art of Empire. And from the description they're having on the display comes from the National Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City. And I am certain, I can imagine that they will not have any goddess artifacts. I'm going to check it out and report back and actually let you know. I'm assuming the goddess artifacts will be included. I can't imagine that they won't be. Okay, I guess if you are new to the show, maybe you just discovered us last week because Blog Talk featured our show. If you'd like to get me to know me a little better, I'm literally an open book. You can go to my website, KarenTate.com. Go there and learn about my books, my examiner column, the classes I teach. It'll also take you to some YouTube clips I have. There's YouTube clips of the Isis Temple of Thanksgiving and Sekhmet's Mountain Sanctuary. There's a 6-part clip you can listen to about the sacred feminine for a sustainable future. And just in case you don't know, I have 2 years of archived radio shows on my website from when I was on Passionate Internet Voices Radio. Yep, they're right there and downloadable and free. I thank those of you who call it a treasure, because that's certainly like gas in my tank. So please keep your feedback coming in and go there when you can and listen. Take advantage of it, please. And I hope you'll check out my favorite articles on my examiner column. It's kind of like my blog. I'm one of only a few goddess advocates in the United States writing for the Examiner, and you can find these articles by going to examiner.com and putting my name in the search box. Articles by me or about me will pop up, or you can find a link on the home page of my website, KarenTate.com. You'll notice I quite often talk about the politics of spirituality, healthcare, sexism, and the inhumanity of political platforms or corporations that always put profits before people. And let's see, what else? Oh, yes, my 2 books. please go to the Goddess Store page, where you will find my two books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, which has garnered prestigious endorsements, and Walking Ancient Paths, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. That won a place as a finalist in the USA National Best Books of 2008. And the scholar David Hillman has remarked that the book Walking Ancient Paths is not only immensely pleasurable and an enlightening journey, but it stands boldly against the patriarchal denigration of the divine feminine. And I have a special for radio show listeners. Both books are $25 plus shipping and handling. That is a better deal than you can get both books new on Amazon. So check it out. You can find all sorts of endorsements and more information about the books at KarenTate.com. Now, remember, here on Blog Talk, we can take your caller questions. So if you like, dial in and ask questions toward the end of the interview. Or you can email me questions in advance. Next week, our guest is going to be Vajrama, and the topic is going to be women's natural spiritual authority. You won't want to miss that, because, ladies, we got to claim it. Because like the Dalai Lama says, it's Western women who are going to be saving the world. That's you and me. And our kindred brothers. Now, if you can't listen live or you don't want to be on the air, you know, like I said, you can always email me some of your questions in advance. But whatever you do, just keep tuning in Wednesday night at 6. Don't miss us. In fact, you can join Blog Talk as a listener and have reminders sent to your email box of our shows so you won't forget about our awesome guests each week. And please, if you're a fan of the show, please indicate that by selecting us as a favorite on Blog Talk Radio. Well, tonight's words of inspiration. I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath with me. Bring an even deeper focus to these lovely words so many of you have said you enjoy hearing and you want to hear over and over again. So I will offer them up one more time, and then probably won't have this on for a while. So please enjoy this tonight. Close your eyes and take a deep breath. Listen to these words of inspiration and affirmation. Let us remember, we not only have to be educated, we have to be informed and aware. We have to know who has our best interests in mind and who will use us, then throw us under the bus. We have to know what's going on out there in the world, even when it's easier to just bury our heads in the sand because it feels so overwhelming at times, or so complicated, or so divisive. Maybe it even sometimes feels hopeless. And dare I say, we take it a bit farther than just being informed and aware. We have to reclaim our sacred feminine voice. You've heard me call it the roar. Yes, the roar. I've talked about it in the context of ancient Greek priestesses and how they served humanity, and I've likened it to the roar of the Egyptian lion-headed goddess Sekhmet. The great she, and by extension us, women everywhere and our like-minded brothers, must claim our feminine roar, our voice. When the great she roars, she is saying, I am alive, I am here, I am growing stronger every day. I offer you the tools for a sustainable future. I offer women empowerment and men partnership. I provide all you need for a joyful and abundant life. Hear me roar. And we are her voice, her hands, and her feet in this life. Let us not forget. So stand up, speak up. Work together and support other women. Ladies, you are being called upon to change the world. And don't forget, Goddess may be the dark horse, but she is coming up from behind to win the race. So, brings the tonight's show to a close. And I'll leave you with one of my favorite musical pieces to end the show. Since we have a little bit more time this week than usual, I'm going to leave you with something a bit ethereal called Lullaby of Love by Leah Scallon, and it's from her Song of Sirius album. So, listeners, thanks for tuning in. I hope you'll be back with us next Wednesday night at 6 o'clock. Until then, let me leave you with this oldie but goodie. It's our marching mantra. Not the church, not the state. Women must decide their fate. So good night, and may the great she embrace you in her golden wings. And here is Lullaby of Love by Leah. Mm-hmm.